Good evening. The central highlands of South Vietnam were a scene of chaos today as up to a quarter of a million refugees and soldiers jammed the roads heading toward the sea. The decision of the government to abandon three provinces in the highlands provoked a retreat which is being compared by some observers to the defeat of the French at Dien Bien Phu in 1954. There were reports that President Tu had negotiated the withdrawal in exchange for the release of civilians in the region, but an official at the American Embassy in Saigon described this as nonsense. In the meantime, the North Vietnamese offensive is continuing, and things are not going well for the government. Here's a satellite report from David Kohler.
The effects of the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong offensive could be seen on the roads not far from Saigon. Government soldiers removed their uniforms in order to retreat faster in the jungle and so that their enemy might mistake them for civilian refugees. Government-controlled newspapers headlined the loss of the Central Highlands as a so-called tactical withdrawal. Since the opposition press has been silenced and many of its reporters thrown in jail, there was only the foreign press to inform the South Vietnamese people. While stopping short of calling it an outright evacuation, a South Vietnamese military spokesman conceded there had been large-scale withdrawals from the Central Highlands for what he termed tactical reasons.
But those movements were made by the tactical demands. And so far, there is no decision yet to withdraw our forces from Pleiku and Kon Tum.
The decision to abandon the highlands is partly explained by the high level of military activity elsewhere in South Vietnam, especially in heavily populated areas not far from Saigon. To send large numbers of troops to the sparsely populated highlands would leave these other areas dangerously underprotected. David Kohler, NBC News, Saigon.
President Tu today ordered a paratroop division to move from Da Nang to Saigon to counter North Vietnamese attacks in nearby provinces. The North Vietnamese have now cut nearly all the main highways and are pressing hard on two district capitals within 50 miles of the capital. In Cambodia, the rebels have increased their shelling and rocketing at Phnom Penh, and we'll have a report from there this evening. We'll cover by satellite the burial today of Aristotle Onassis at his private island off the coast of Greece. And we'll have a special report from Tom Pettit this evening, another in his series of special reports on feeding the poor. Rebel rockets and shells continued to land in Phnom Penh today, and Cambodian government troops returned the fire in heavy exchanges. Today is the fifth anniversary of the ouster of Prince Norodom Sihanouk and the installation of the government of Marshal Lon Nol. Nearly all of the country is now in the hands of the rebels. And the rebels today concentrated their fire on a strategically important peninsula between the Tonle Sap River and the Mekong River. The city's waterworks and a naval base are located there. Here's more on the Phnom Penh story from Jim Laurie.
These are the latest victims of rocket attacks which have lately been concentrated on Chung Chang Var, an area just across the Tonle Sap and Mekong rivers from the heart of Phnom Penh. The people are mainly farmers and fishermen and their families. The only means of escape is by small boat and sampan across the river. More than 50 rounds of Chinese-made rockets pounded this area for 24 hours. No one knows exactly what the toll is in killed and wounded. The principal military target in the area for the Cambodian insurgents is a Phnom Penh Navy base along the river. But the insurgents also apparently see the region as a potential approach for an attack on Phnom Penh. Jim Laurie, NBC News, Phnom Penh.
Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield today rejected President Ford's assertion that the continuation of a non-communist government in Cambodia is vital to the security of the United States. Mansfield said Cambodia is not tied to our security. Mansfield also said that even if the president agrees to an end of June cutoff in Cambodia aid, that aid package will still have trouble getting through the Congress. That cutoff and the whole Cambodian situation were discussed by the president and Republican leaders at the White House today. Tom Brokaw has that story.
Republican congressional leaders were told during their White House meeting that morale in the Cambodian government is very low. Senate Minority Leader Hugh Scott blamed that on congressional Democrats.
They have, by caucus, agreed to abandon Cambodia in both the House and Senate Democratic caucuses. And I think that speaks for itself. The president has certainly not written off Cambodia. I say this is a runaway Congress where compassion has taken second place to expediency.
Another member of the Republican group, Congressman William Broomfield of Michigan, said later he told the president there wasn't much chance of aid to Cambodia unless the administration would accept a cutoff on further assistance. According to Broomfield, the president said he was not interested in such a compromise. White House officials say Mr. Ford is adamant on that point. One senior presidential advisor said the president is making his argument very forcefully to anyone who will listen. He doesn't want a cutoff. Tom Brokaw, NBC News at the White House.
This afternoon, the White House said the situation in South Vietnam shows the need for the Congress to approve the $300 million which the administration has asked for Saigon. Ron Nessen, the press secretary, told reporters that one reason the South Vietnamese have fallen back is that they lack guaranteed fuel and ammunition supplies. And while the White House was prodding the Congress on falling dominoes in Southeast Asia, the Senate had this reaction.
On Capitol Hill today, there was more concern over getting a tax cut through Congress than there was over falling dominoes in Asia. President Ford found little enthusiasm for his argument that United States security is tied to some Asian countries, especially among Democrats, although some Republicans did support the president.
So I buy the domino theory. I think that it's apparent when you can see that two successive governments in Thailand in the last few days have suggested the Americans should depart. That's an indication that they feel that the American presence is no longer viable in Southeast Asia.
Arguments have been contrived to keep us in Vietnam all these many years, and now in Cambodia, and in Thailand, if you please. Our security never has been at stake in that part of the world. That's why new arguments have to be thought up every year to keep us there. And there comes a time when a grown-up people should say enough.
Some Democrats say that President Ford is engaged in a word war with Congress, so he will have someone to blame if Cambodia falls. These Democrats say that if President Ford really believed United States security is involved in Cambodia, then he would ask Congress for troops and a lot more money. Catherine Mackin, NBC News, Washington.
The House of Representatives today overwhelmingly approved a tough bill to regulate the strip mining of coal. A similar bill has been passed by the Senate. The differences in the two bills will be ironed out at a House-Senate conference committee. Last December, President Ford vetoed a strip mining bill which imposed a stiff environmental and reclamation, imposed stiff environmental and reclamation controls. And today, the coal industry urged another veto when the bill gets to the White House. The Reverend Billy Graham reported today that Richard Nixon has turned to religion in what the evangelist called the former president's time of disappointment and illness. Graham said he and Nixon shared 2.5 hours of prayer and discussion about the Bible at San Clemente earlier this month, and he said the word Watergate was never mentioned. There's a strike of interns and resident doctors in 20 New York nonprofit and city hospitals. The strikers, however, aren't looking for more money. They want their hours cut down, and today they got backing of the two top officers of the American Medical Association. Doctors Richard Palmer and Malcolm Todd called the walkout a strike for better patient care. They said that unduly long hours not only hurt doctors, but also the quality of the care they give the patients. And there's something else involved, a difference in philosophy between generations. Richard Hunt has the story.
Time is the central issue in the New York doctors' strike. The hours and weeks that young doctors are required to serve while they're in training as interns and residents. The strikers say they sometimes work 110 hours a week, occasionally 56 hours at a single stretch. And that changes their feelings about their work and their patients. This is Dr. Richard Knutson, president of the Committee of Interns and Residents.
It's 5:30 in the morning, and you get that admission just about the time you were physiologically prepared to hit the sack for an hour or two before rounds again. And here comes Joe Patient. I don't care how empathetic you are, there comes a point where you honestly reach, at some time during your medical training career, where you really wish this one wouldn't make it.
Dr. David Pomerantz, director of Mount Sinai Hospital, says long hours are part of a doctor's training.
I find it hard to believe that these people who were below 30 in age, between early 20s and 30, a few were just a bit over 30, can be in that bad physical condition. For a century, doctors have been working like this, and indeed longer. I hate to use my own example, but I worked 2 nights out of 3 when I was an intern, not 1 night out of 3.
But outside on the picket line, the authority of older doctors is no longer accepted automatically. These young doctors were in college during the protest days of the 60s.
It taught us that what is right, even if the authorities happen to disagree. And it taught you that it's better to stand up for your ideals, if you have them, than to submit to unreasonable authority.
The doctor's strike seems to be more than just a strike. It involves a growing difference between generations and an expanding new school of thought about just what a doctor's duty should be. Another strike is scheduled next month in Chicago. Richard Hunt, NBC News, New York.
Some new notes on the economy, on the recession. Housing permits in February dropped to an all-time low. Housing starts were down almost 2% from January. The Home Loan Bank Board reported a drop in mortgage rates, but that could be the result of people simply not being in a position to buy. And two big New York banks, Chemical and Morgan Guaranty, dropped their prime lending rate 0.25 point to 7.5%, an indication that general interest rates will come down in the months ahead. In Moscow today, Victoria Fyodorova, the young Russian actress who's never seen her American father, said that she has received permission to visit him in the United States. The girl's mother, an Admiral Jackson Tate, now retired, had a love affair during World War II. Tate was sent home. Stalin was annoyed at that romance, but the mother went to prison on an espionage charge. Tate is 77 now. He has a bad heart and lives in Orange Park, Florida, with his wife. He was overjoyed at the prospect of a visit from the child he has never seen. Here's the way Tate put it.
My immediate reaction is one of thankfulness to Secretary Brezhnev and the Russian people for this great gesture of humanitarianism. I thank them from the bottom of my heart, and I hope that Victoria will become an envoy of understanding and peace between the Soviet and the American people. It is our greatest hope that this will be the major result of this reunion. And that, gentlemen, is all I can say at this time. I'm overcome, I am tired and ill, and I think it's a marvelous thing that she will get here. Thank you.
The Supreme Court ruled 7-1 today that there is no obligation on the part of the individual states to pay welfare benefits for unborn children. Now, that's a current policy in 35 states. Federal regulations give individual states a choice, and today's ruling upheld those states which have chosen not to provide such benefits for the unborn. Tonight, we have another in our series of special reports on Feeding the Poor by Tom Pettit. Poor is a word with many meanings and many classifications. There are different kinds of poor people. And among the poorest of the poor are the 6 to 7 million illegal aliens in this country. Most of these poor can't get help because if they reveal themselves to the authorities, they'll be thrown out of the country. Many of them are desperate and hungry. In Los Angeles County, the authorities believe there are 600,000 illegal aliens. Here's a report on a family in that illegal community.
This woman lives in fear. Fear that she will not have enough food for her family. Fear that she and her children will be deported to Mexico. Because she is in the country illegally, we cannot give her true name. We will call her Mrs. Lopez. 4 children were born in Mexico. One, her 10-year-old daughter, works part-time as a domestic. But Victor, age 4, actually supports the family. Welfare pays $129 a month for Victor because he is a United States citizen since he was born here. The Lopez family lives on food stamps, even though if that fact were discovered, they might face deportation. The older children get 2 free meals at school, but were it not for food stamps, their other meals would be very meager. Nobody knows how many families like this live like this. There simply are no statistics. Just as there are no statistics about their health problems or their nutrition problems. We do know that, like poor people everywhere, they face the constant threat of nutritional anemia. This problem exists in the midst of Southern California's opulence. It is not a new problem. The Lopez family lives on the east side of Los Angeles, in the barrio, the neighborhood where Mexicans long have lived. Where for many people, Spanish remains the language of everyday life. Where unemployment is higher than the rest of the county. Where Mexicans without papers can blend into the sizable Chicano community. Many families have been here for generations, but very often new babies are the first in their families to be U.S. citizens. This baby boy became a citizen 1 minute ago, when he was born. His mother does not have immigration papers. She is what they call an illegal alien. The mother also is seriously anemic. And the odds are 1 in 3 that this baby boy will be anemic by the time he is 1 year old. Dr. Alma Korn, a pediatrician for the county, says anemia comes because parents cannot afford enough iron-rich foods like meat. Sometimes they cannot afford milk.
If you substitute rice water for a meal of milk, the volume that the baby has to take is such a large amount that a baby with a small stomach can't drink all that volume, so he just drinks enough to get rid of the hunger pangs.
Pregnant women examined at county clinics in East Los Angeles face an epidemic of anemia. 1 in 4 is anemic, and the rate is rising as they face high meat prices and rising unemployment. They have even greater health problems if they also happen to have immigration problems. Dr. Robert Setledge.
People without papers are much more reluctant to get services, to come to a clinic for care, to seek help from agencies that are supposedly established to help people with problems. Of course, the other thing that's probably more important is that there are very few resources that are available to non-citizens. They are excluded from eligibility for food stamps, as an example.
The Lopez family is taking the risk of deportation by getting food stamps anyway, even though they are not eligible. Without stamps, there is no doubt all 5 children would suffer. And this raises some questions. Since Victor is a U.S. citizen, is he entitled to the benefits of food stamps? Should he have them but not his brothers and sisters, or his mother? As human beings, would they all be better off in Mexico? Or is mercy not a factor in feeding the poor? Tom Pettit, NBC News, East Los Angeles.
Many Americans who are hungry and who need help belong to a culture of the poor. And some families have been poor and hungry for more than 2 generations. In his next report, Pettit will show us how a hungry grandfather's attitude toward charity differs from that of his hungry grandchildren. Differences between generations, it seems, apply equally to the rich and the poor. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger said today in Jerusalem that there is still substantial disagreement between Israel and Egypt over a new Israeli withdrawal in the Sinai Desert. But Kissinger said he will continue to go from Israel to Egypt until he either works out an agreement or decides that he can't. In Budapest today, Soviet Communist leader Leonid Brezhnev said that any Middle East peace must guarantee the existence and security of the State of Israel. But Brezhnev also told the Hungarian Communist Party Congress that the Palestinians must have their own state and that Israel must give up all occupied Arab territories. British Prime Minister Harold Wilson's Labour government said today that it will advise that country's people to vote to stay in the European Common Economic Community, the Common Market. A national referendum on the issue will be held in Britain late in June. The leftist Portuguese military government today forbade members of three opposition political parties to vote in the election scheduled for next month. The parties are the Christian Democrats on the right and the Maoists and Worker Peasant Alliance of the far left. On the island of Scorpios, which he owned, Aristotle Onassis was buried today. His widow, the former Jacqueline Kennedy, and his daughter Christina were among those who saw the body of Onassis placed near that of his only son, Alexander, killed 2 years ago in a plane crash. We have a satellite report from Garrett.
This is the village of Needry, a fishing village, where Onassis and his wife Jacqueline could come for an occasional taste of the simple Greek life. And it was from here today that Onassis made his final journey to his island.
The people of Nitri village gathered at the waterfront as the body of Aristotle Onassis was brought from a nearby airport. It had been flown from Paris, where he died. Onassis' giant ship sailed the world, but his casket was placed aboard one of his smallest for the final one-mile trip to his private island. Immediately behind came his daughter, Christina, 24, who will inherit the bulk of his wealth, over $500 million. And behind her, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. With her, Senator Edward Kennedy. Estimates of what she will inherit range from $100 million down to only $10 million. Onassis had already set up a multi-million dollar trust fund for the two Kennedy children. It was chilly and windy as the three boats set out for the Scorpios Island where Onassis had built his vast estate. The simple funeral was held in a tiny chapel where he and his wife Jacqueline were married 7 years ago. And on Scorpios, Aristotle Onassis was buried near his only son who died in the plane crash 2 years ago. Garrick Utley, NBC News, Scorpios, Greece.
And good night for NBC News.